This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Robert Schuller and his family are leaving the Crystal Cathedral. It is a sea change for the megachurch that towers over Orange County, California. The family is synonymous with the church. Robert Schuller founded it and launched its Hour of Power TV show. But in recent years, the Crystal Cathedral has fallen on hard times. Here's more from NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty.
Yesterday's Hour of Power opened with characteristic optimism.
If you need a lift today, you've tuned to the right program. Join us for the best hour on television, the Hour of Power from the Crystal Cathedral.
But when senior pastor Sheila Schuller Coleman began her sermon, she acknowledged that she does not always practice the positive thinking that she preaches.
So, for instance, this past week, my attitude was a little down, a little negative, making life miserable for the people around me, but most of all, myself.
Understandable, perhaps. Schuller Coleman is Robert Schuller's daughter, and she, along with the entire Schuller family, is cutting ties with the Crystal Cathedral. On Saturday, Robert Schuller, his wife, and daughter Carol announced that they are resigning from the board because of the, quote, adversarial and negative attitude of the other board members. They allege the church owes them money, something the church disputes. Now Schuller Coleman is looking for another place to preach.
This is definitely the end of an era.
Jonathan Walton is an assistant professor at Harvard Divinity School. He says when Robert Schuller opened his doors in 1955, America was in a post-war boom, economically and spiritually.
Robert Schuller's early preaching caught the spiritual strivings and desires of a post-war generation that wanted to have more, that wanted to do more, and that wanted to be more.
With the wind of positive thinking in his sails, the young Robert Schuller, a pastor in the Reformed Church in America, expanded his congregation to some 10,000 people. Millions more tuned into his services on the televised Hour of Power. He hired architect Philip Johnson to build the Crystal Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. But when Schuller tried to pass a baton to his children, Walton says, the church faltered. They preached the same positive Christianity, but without the charisma.
I think this is a quintessential example of a failure to institutionalize charismatic leadership so that it can stand the test of time.
The members grew grayer, their numbers dwindled, and so did their contributions. Meanwhile, Walton says, the church never figured out how to reach a younger generation.
We see preachers that may not have the tools of production to produce an hour of power, but they can produce 3 minutes of power on YouTube. An hour of power just may be too exhausting for Generation Y.
Crystal Cathedral Ministries filed for bankruptcy 2 years ago, and last year the building was bought by the Catholic Diocese in Orange County. The church is planning to rent back the building for up to 3 years. But in a web video yesterday, Sheila Schuller Coleman said she's taking the choir and some of the staff to a new place to worship.
We are going to need a new home sooner than we thought, and we're moving full speed ahead.
She said the church will be called Hope Center OC, of Christ, and she hopes to find a location within a week. In the meantime, those who want to worship at the Crystal Cathedral may do so, though the church says it does not yet know who will be preaching. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
Britons are struggling with the issue of faith in the workplace. Two British women, one an airline employee and the other a nurse, were suspended or barred from doing their jobs because they wore crucifixes at work. Now the two are taking their case to the European Court of Human Rights. To find out how this debate is playing out in the UK, we called Lucy Calloway. She's a columnist for the Financial Times, and she joined us from London. Lucy, good to talk to you again.
Hello.
In the U.S., wearing a cross on the end of a chain or a crucifix or any symbol of religious belief is rather common. So what was or what is the logic of the employers, in this case British Airways and the National Health Service, and now the government, which backs them, in deciding that people cannot display a tiny crucifix on a chain at work?
Well, it's against the uniform policy. I mean, the uniform policy in both cases said no visible jewellery, and a crucifix is a piece of visible jewellery, and they were told they couldn't wear it. They both replied that this was part of their religious faith, and so in preventing them from wearing it, they were being prevented from practising their religion. What then happens is complicated, because the argument is then made quite reasonably that if you're a Christian, you don't have to wear a crucifix. fics. That's a matter of personal choice. It's not as if you're a Muslim, in which case you do need to wear the scarf, or if you're a Sikh, you need to wear the turban. So British Airways argued that it was perfectly voluntary whether or not you wore the cross, but their uniform wasn't voluntary, and if you were a member of staff, you needed to follow it.
But in general, do employees there in the UK not wear crosses or other indications of their faith at work?
I think it's much less common than in the US. And what you also have is lots of people, sort of groovy young teenagers, they might wear sort of aggressive looking crosses without being religious. They just wear it because they think it's funky. So the simple fact that you're wearing a cross doesn't necessarily mean that you're a sincere Christian.
What are average people saying about this?
I mean, I think almost everybody sensible is behind these two women. Who can say that any harm is being done whatsoever by these women? The UK was originally a Christian country. I think people feel that it's quite outrageous as a simple practical matter that they weren't allowed to wear these small, inoffensive crucifixes.
What if British Airways, though, said it's not about her religion, it's still about the jewellery?
Well, I think that's what they were saying, that this contravened their policy and therefore wasn't allowed. But I mean, I think that more sensible companies have rules and then police them intelligently. I think that, you know, it's perfectly plausible that they could turn a blind eye to someone wearing a small cross that's completely inoffensive and not turn a blind eye if someone comes in with a massive, great bling crucifix that's sort of practically concussing passengers as they hand them their drinks. They could very sensibly say that that was another matter altogether.
What happens now? The two women have gone to the European Court of Human Rights. Is it likely that they'll prevail in that court? And if they were to, what effect might it have on the ruling there in Britain?
Well, I mean, I don't really know, but I think it's not likely that they will win. At any rate, the British government has weighed in against them, pointing out again that the simple fact of being a Christian does not require you to wear the crucifix. So, you know, that's quite a clear sway.
Lucy Calloway is a columnist with the Financial Times, speaking to us from London. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's time for Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. Today we want to look at confession, or should I say the art of confession. That's the title of a new book by Paul Wilkes. He is a Catholic, but he says this is a practice that people of all religious persuasions and none can benefit from. And Paul Wilkes joins us now to talk about his latest book. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
In the book, you point out that this is actually a confessional culture right now. You know, maybe a generation ago, you wouldn't hear about, except, you know, through the neighborhood grapevine, things like alcoholism or problems that people are having, you know, in their marriages. But now you say that people are ready and willing to confess every wrong and every guilty pleasure to anybody who will listen on chat rooms, on TV. What's the difference between that kind of confession and the one that you suggest?
Speaking of that, Michelle, if you just stand in line at the supermarket, people talking on their cell phones, you'll hear more than you ever heard anywhere in a confessional 30 years ago. I think the problem is that this is that kind of surface blurts that we go through about our lives, but there really isn't the deep reflection on who we are, what we are, why we're doing, what we like that we do, and what we don't like what we do. It's very simple that you do not find the secret you or the deepest you or the best you in the supermarket line or on a chat room or Twittering. You find that in the deepest recesses of your soul, and that takes time, and that's why I call this the art of confession, not the big C in the Catholic Church, confession, but a small C, because the first confession is always to ourselves.
You said that confession can be understood as an emptying to make room for something better. And you said, as we will discuss, a continual practice of honesty. Talk a little bit about that.
I think anybody that thinks about this realizes that when we have a burden on our souls, if we've been ugly to the people we work with, if we've been misappropriating funds, if we've been cheating on our wives, if we're continually in an angry state, that really isn't the best in us, and it doesn't make us feel very good. And confession, I think, allows us to release all that, to come into this wonderful light that is our soul. And sometimes we've just kind of varnished it over, or we think we're by blurting it out, it's doing something, but it isn't. We haven't really looked deeply into ourselves, and we really haven't made the choice to do something different about our lives.
Well, you point out in the book that many religious traditions have a tradition of confession. But how do you get started if, number one, you don't belong to one of those religious traditions, or for whatever reason you find, if you are one of those people who finds that the means that you have perhaps been taught within a religious tradition are lacking, what do you recommend?
I have a motto that I've gotten from a great Dominican who said, never let the church get in the way of your relationship with God. I believe that from the primeval days to 21st century, from New Age to Buddhism to Catholicism to Protestantism, Judaism, it's not so dissimilar. And here's a simple way. Tonight, before you go to bed, kneel down beside your bed and just think about the day. The Jesuits call it consolations and desolations. Consolations means, when was I the best person I could be? When did I really do something? When I made that movement toward that coworker that I've been having problems with? Or on the other hand, when I really sniped, I talked behind her back again. And just by acknowledging that to yourself, you automatically say, I want to do more of the first and less of the second. If you happen to believe in God, as do I say, God, you know, kneel here beside me. Just be with me as I'm trying to reflect on this day and help me to be honest. I do it every night.
I was going to ask you that. Is this something that you recommend that you do every day and that you recommend that others do every day as kind of a daily accounting?
Look, if you play tennis once a year, you're going to have sore muscles. If you play tennis three times a week, you're not going to have sore muscles, and it's going to be you're going to play a better game. I do it every day because I'm a sinful man every day. I do stupid things. I do arrogant things. I do impatient things on a daily basis. But unless I do it on a daily basis, these compound, and then they become just part of the fabric of my life.
What about the idea of accountability from others, the community, from a spiritual leader? You know, as we know, we're living in a period where a lot of people have a lot of problems with authority, and they're not interested in inviting any more into their lives. But other people do, you know, feel that really the only true accountability comes with community or with the presence of some kind of obedience to something outside of oneself. How do you address that?
Well, I was just giving a talk in Austin, Texas, and a woman said that she has an accountability partner. That one person in your life who you can trust anything with, who isn't judgmental about you, who you really can have the best conversation about the deepest things. If you're accountable to another person, as you could be to the rabbi, minister, or priest, or therapist, this can be your accountability partner, which may not be your partner.
Why do you call the book The Art of Confession?
This is not a dull knife or a heavy club that you beat yourself over the head with. This is an art to be practiced, because sometimes you're supposed to go to people and say, I'm sorry I did this. Other times, the best way to do it is not to say anything to anybody else. There isn't this kind of Reader's Digest 10 easy steps to confession. Each person has to practice it as an art.
And before we let you go, what sparked this particular book? You're the author of a number of books on spirituality. Is there anything in particular that made you feel, you know, I really need to talk about this?
Really, as I got more into it, I found out how shallow our confession is today and how we've lost that connection, not only with the purifying possibilities of confession, but we've lost touch with ourselves. And I think that we think that by sharing so much, we're so honest, whereas we're getting shallower and shallower and shallower. Take that little time tonight. As they used to say in the old commercials, try it, you'll like it. See what happens. If it doesn't work for you, then goodbye, Paul Wilkes. But if it does, hello for the rest of my life.
Okay. Paul Wilkes, as we said, is the author of many books on spirituality, most recently The Art of Confession. He joined us from member station WHQR in Wilmington, North Carolina. Paul Wilkes, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Michelle. Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. Over the centuries, 104 men have led the worldwide Anglican Communion, and soon it will be time for one more. Today, the current Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, made the surprise announcement that he's stepping down at the end of the year. He'll take a post at Cambridge University. NPR's Philip Reeves has this story on his challenging tenure.
Williams will only be 62 when he hands over his robes and mitre. That's young for an archbishop. For nearly 10 years, Williams has been the religious head of the Church of England and of a worldwide Anglican communion of some 80 million people. He's held the post during a particularly difficult period, says his fellow Welshman, the Archbishop of Wales, Barry Morgan.
It's just unfortunate that he came to be Archbishop at a time when the communion was being riven apart by issues of human sexuality. And I think what he's tried to do is to hold the church together, whatever his own personal views.
Williams hasn't said whether those issues, the ordination of gay clergy and women bishops, led him to decide to leave. They're causing deep divisions, notably between conservative clerics in Africa and their more liberal counterparts in North America. Williams is candid, though, about how tough it is to lead his church these days.
I think that it's a job of immense demands, and I would hope that my successor has the constitution of an ox and the skin of a rhinoceros, really.
The bearded Williams once described himself as a typical hairy lefty. But as Archbishop of Canterbury, he's found himself under fire from left and right. Liberals in the church felt he failed to enforce his views. Conservatives saw him as unacceptably liberal, especially over issues like homosexuality. Alison Ruoff, a member of the Church of England's Parliament, the General Synod, praises Williams as wise and godly, but adds,
I'm sure it's right that he returns to academia because under Archbishop Rowan's tenure, the church has really gone in a most liberal direction. And many, many churches have gone away from Bible truth.
Williams has been willing over the years to court controversy by tackling British governments over political issues, including the Iraq War and overpaid and reckless bankers. He's sought to build bridges with Britain's Muslim community, and in 2008 caused a furore by saying Britain should incorporate aspects of Sharia law, explaining it thus.
It seems unavoidable, and indeed, as a matter of fact, certain provisions of Sharia are already recognised in our society and under our law. So it's not as if we're bringing in an alien and rival system.
Speculation's begun over who'll replace Williams. The bookie's favourite is reportedly the Ugandan-born Archbishop of York, John Setamu. He'd be the first black Archbishop of Canterbury. Meanwhile, tributes are pouring into Williams from inside and outside the church. Ruth Gledhill, religious affairs correspondent of the London Times, says Williams is loved by people at the grassroots, but she says this doesn't come across at the political level.
The tragedy of Rowan Williams is that he's a man of enormous gifts, gifts that the world and the church has both failed and not been able to appreciate because of the schismatic battles within his own church, and it has to be said because of the way he's dealt with those battles.
Philip Reeves, NPR News, London.